25. It's not my money to tithe. On the morning of January 8, 2009, 12 days before Barack Obama's inauguration as president, Rex Tillerson arrived at the Ronald Reagan Building on Pennsylvania Avenue, two blocks from the White House, to announce ExxonMobil's new lobbying position on climate change. He made his way to the rear of the cavernous Reagan Building, which housed several government agencies. Upstairs, at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, a government-supported think tank, Tillerson strode into an amphitheater where about 100 scholars, researchers, and journalists had gathered. He took the podium and unfolded a printed speech. He ticked through the corporation's positions on American energy policy. Washington needed long-range thinking. Rising global demand for oil and gas through 2030 was inevitable. America, therefore, needed to develop all our energy resources. And it was particularly urgent to open up offshore and other domestic territory to drilling. Normally, the ExxonMobil chairman resisted arguments that pandered to the American yearning for energy independence, since he regarded the very idea as misguided. Yet if measured appeals to American nationalism were necessary to win approval for domestic oil drilling, he was willing to make them. There is enough oil and natural gas offshore and in non-wilderness and non-parked lands to fuel 50 million cars and heat nearly 100 million homes for the next 25 years, he declared. He referred to climate change impassively as an important global issue. The incoming Obama administration proposed to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by enacting a cap-and-trade system in which polluters could buy and sell pollution credits under an overall cap. Tillerson argued that Europe's similar system, inaugurated several years earlier, did not work well and had introduced unnecessary cost and complexity while creating problems with verification and accountability. In Beijing in 1997, Lee Raymond had delivered a landmark speech in which he argued that the evidence suggested global warming was not taking place at all. Ever since, ExxonMobil's leaders had criticized public policies to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, such as the Kyoto Protocol, cap-and-trade proposals, and alternative energy subsidies. That morning in Washington, however, Tillerson's speech took an unexpected turn. For the first time in ExxonMobil's century-long history, its chairman went on to advocate that the government impose higher taxes on oil and gas use to reduce the risks posed by climate change. There is another policy option that should be considered, and that is a carbon tax. As a businessman, it is hard to speak favorably about any new tax. But a carbon tax strikes me as a more direct, a more transparent, and a more effective approach. Such a tax should be made revenue neutral. In other words, the size of government need not increase. The idea of a carbon sin tax, comparable to the excise taxes imposed on tobacco products, had a distinctive history. Then Senator Al Gore proposed a version of the tax in his 1992 best-selling book, Earth in the Balance. Gore suggested that revenue from a carbon-based fuels tax be used to reduce payroll taxes on salaried Americans. Tax pollution, not work, was his rhetorical flourish. Advocates at some ardent environmental lobbies, such as Greenpeace and the Rainforest Action Network, advanced Gore's proposal in the years afterward. Some of their leaders and thinkers preferred a broad carbon tax to regulator-heavy cap-and-trade systems. The latter allowed some polluters to buy their way out of accountability for their emissions. On the ideological right, some free-market tax economists, such as Kevin Hassett at the American Enterprise Institute, also endorsed the carbon tax after Gore proposed it, on the grounds of its relative economic efficiency. Tillerson and right-leaning economists argued that such a tax should be neutral, that is, revenues raised should be returned to taxpayers, perhaps by a reduction in the payroll tax. At a time of fiscal strain, however, a carbon tax also had the potential to shore up federal finances. At $20 to $25 per ton, the range around which there was the greatest political support, a tax could raise at least $100 billion annually. By the time of the 2008 presidential campaign, however, the carbon tax had become a politically marginal and quixotic proposal. Cap-and-trade's intellectual history, too, reflected a compromise between conservatives and environmentalists. The first Bush administration embraced the system as a market-based way to control acid rain, and succeeded. Many of the large corporations that would be directly affected if carbon taxation of any kind was imposed, electric utilities that burned coal, for example, had concluded that they could manage their interests most successfully by lobbying for a tailored cap-and-trade program that eased their transition to higher carbon costs. The very efficiency of a carbon tax caused some coal-dependent utility executives to shudder because such a pure tax would hit every corporation in proportion to its polluting activity. By comparison, a global corporation of ExxonMobil's profitability could absorb the financial hit, and in any event, it did not produce coal, the greatest greenhouse gas offender. A modest-sized, locally regulated American coal utility might see its profits and market value shrink dramatically. Under a carbon tax, this explained the breadth of business support for cap-and-trade. ExxonMobil had already conducted detailed reviews of cap-and-trade versus a direct carbon tax in 2006, as part of a climate strategy review Tillerson had ordered after becoming chief executive. Ken Cohen and other executives recoiled from cap-and-trade systems because of the system's susceptibility to manipulation by speculators and other distorting complexities. They also loathed the idea of a new federal regulatory system with which they would have to comply.